Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening.
Oh, God. Wait till it's recording first, then. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the China Shop, home of the Band of Traders podcast. I'm your host, Kyle, and joining us today, we've got Head of Quality Control, Joel MC, and we've got a special guest this week, Eric Mason, the informal economist. Got some idea what we're going to talk about, but I don't think anyone's really completely sure, so maybe I'll just open up the floor and let you guys say whatever you want. Promote, plug, tell some stories. I don't know. Dance, monkeys.
Dance. I mean, I was about, when we were in pre-show, I was about to go on a rant about, no, you guys can't see this, about like I have humidors and stuff behind me on both sides of me.
Except for the cigars?
Yeah, yes. that's a good question. That's a good question. So, you know, I teach and I always feel awkward because like I have like my the students this semester are awesome. I love them. But like, you know, I have office hours and I have kids in there and I can see their eyes like looking over to what's behind me. Cause one of them's like, my brother got me a couple of Christmases ago, an antique humidor from 1922 and they're still in high school. So it's very funny cause they're still used to like a teacher and not necessarily like an instructor or professor relationship. So looking at them, one of the kids, I was like, yeah, it's a humidor. And you could tell like that was an awkward, like, oh, like the idea that like smoking cigars. And again, obviously if you're a 16-year-old, why are you listening to this podcast? But, but like the idea that you could like you'd be talking about smoking cigars.
The fact you're storing them in your classroom, I think that's a little, where do you teach at?
Yeah, right. <I'm> just... Mountaineers, WVU, my alum, that's my alma mater.
Can you trust them? Do they disappear from there?
For what? For me? Oh, this is my home office. So wife.
You teach remote, huh?
Yeah. Okay. Unless my wife starts stealing cigars, which I wouldn't blame her, if I'm being honest. But heavily smoking. I'm amped up on the job report. That's what I'm excited to talk about.
Well, before we do that, I got to ask you first about, I got Rick Kosha signed up to talk to him on Tuesday. Now, we're probably going to talk about like the Quincy Bond, some of like the lessons learned and awesome. Stuff like that. But I know he's worked in some really cool positions in the past. Do you have any stories that I can pin him for or try to get him on the hook to tell us?
Yeah. So like Rick is the, love him. Like I was at, we took a half day today and went to the range together, just him and I, which like, you know, him and I get along very, very well. Dude, he's like the ultimate professional. Like outlandish things I say to that man, who, and he just like straight lay, straight face. Like, no, he's really like, it's funny because he's like wicked humble. Like, when it came to the blockchain bond, like he was a guy, he was in every meeting. He wrangled all the cats, worked with everybody. And he just like, you try and give him credit for anything. He just like doesn't want to accept it. It's like, dude, you were Technically, Rick was the person who sold the first blockchain bond in the U.S. So the day of the sale, we're sitting down and the closing's going down. It's really, really hectic because, you know, everything is conjecture until it happens, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we're sitting in front of Rick's computer. We just finished the final pricing. And, you know, when you – this sounds very goofy, but when you sell a bond, like, they physically turn to us and say, this is the price, and we have to accept it at every year of every price. Mm-hmm. If we say no, it's not sold. That sounds a little antiquated and theatrical, but that's how it works.
So even with the blockchain one?
Even with the blockchain, because you still have to do the price, the underwriting for the pricing has to be agreed upon.
Okay.
So we're sitting there and, you know, we're on the call and, you know, they looked at me and they're like, all right. And they start reading off and they're waiting for me to respond. I was about to respond. And I was like, I was going to say a worse word, but I was like, that'd be such a jerk move. Like, this dude carried this thing for like 9 months. So I turned to Rick and I was like, I'm not saying anything. I'll go, you say it. And he, dude, the guy's like, no. Like, he did one of those, like, oh, you know, it's a team effort.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, do you want the Patriots? Again, podcast, I'm wearing a Patriots shirt right now. That's like being like, you know what? It's a team effort. You know, Tom Brady should really think of it as a team effort. It's like, if you win six of them, you may be the common denominator.
Hey, yeah, so, he only sold one.
Yeah.
Let him get a couple more under the belt before we start anointing him the great one of bond sales.
Dude. he also did the largest pension obligation bond in state history. So he's got at least two.
Okay. I thought that was yours, too. You just taking all his, is that what it is?
Oh, I just take all his credit. That's what I tell you. I hire smart people and they take credit for what they do.
I'm going to tell him he puts the Rick in Eric.
Dude, that'd be sick. Tell him that. But, yeah, so I turned him. I was like, you sell it. And, you know, he was kind of like, you know, him being professional and respectful, he didn't want to do it. I was like, of course, maybe the jerk. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm like mouthing off on the call. And he does it. I'm like, I'm not taking credit for this. Even like a couple days ago, we're in front of Quincy. So we're in front of the Board of Governors for Quincy College. And we're talking about one of the board members, great lady. She's telling us, I was on Harris, Chicago University's Harris Business School's podcast like a couple weeks ago, came out. And she was like, Eric, I really enjoyed listening to that, yada, yada. I'm sitting up there. I'm like, yeah, I just like, if you guys have any questions on that, like, works over there. like, he's the dude who did it. Like, I can walk on the economics and the benefits of it. But, like, you know, the finance side of it, the thing I think a lot of people find interesting, like, that's straight up Rick. If you could bring up his Gregory Peck outfit, that would be also
Gregory,
a good thing.
Oh,
get him running.
Okay. Nice.
Dude, he is the best dresser of any human being I've ever met in my life. Like, it is hilarious. He's
be nice if we could ever get him out of his house.
That would, no, honestly, one of the things I love about Rick is that he's kind of like a homebody, which I am too for the large part. And he walks in one day to work, and he is, because working for JPM, working for Eaton Vance, working for, like, you know, Fidelity and all this stuff. Like, he's great suits. Like, you know, I'm a big believer, like, you know, I'm a millennial, and so I'm a big believer in, like, you dress for your day, like, you dress for what you have to wear. And, like, it took a long time to get Rick into jeans on Fridays. Mm-hmm. Like, I had people who wear, like, sandals to work. Like, I'm like, dude, you wear jeans. I have one rule in my office. People can't wear shorts, and I don't think that rule's even followed that hardly, if I'm being honest. It's unprofessional. I don't want you wearing shorts. Like, if you're gonna go golfing, just take the day off. So I walk in one day, like, I love Atticus Finch. He's like my favorite, like, literary character, and I don't even read fiction, but I love To Kill a Mockingbird. I'm like, Rick, you are dressed like Atticus Finch right now. And he goes, do you know who played Atticus Finch in the movie? And I like have like random old, like, older movie, older pop culture knowledge. So I'm like, yeah, it's Gregory Peck, right? He's a three-piece suit, dude. It's the dopest suit in the world. And he just, like, lost it for the day. He's like, I hate that you know who Gregory Peck is. What a random knowledge rule to have.
All right, one last question. I gotta get Joel some FaceTime over here. Sitting over there quietly muted.
Looking awesome in yellow underarm. I feel so upstaged right now. I'm very sad.
I'm the color.
Yeah, that's right. what was I just about to ask? Fuck me. I guess you've been asking about the jobs report. We can just go ahead and move on into that. Joel, did you pay attention to anything with the report coming out?
Only that there was a bounce and a retrace.
So that's about what the trader experience is when looking at job reports. So yep. Was there anything that you saw, Eric, that caught your eye?
I mean, everybody talks about like adding a quarter million.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought the fall in unemployment is was great because, like, dude, we're so spoiled. We act like 4% unemployment's like horrible, and so everybody's like, oh, it was 3%. I'm like, dude, 3% is about as efficient unemployment you can possibly get. Right. And you know, so once it was like 4.2, I know some places had adjusted to 4.3 and it fell down. I mean, everybody, the consensus was it was going to be 4.2, 4.3 again. It ended up falling to 4.1, and that's awesome. Like, one of the things my mentor in economics when I was an undergrad, he used to always say to me, like, it's okay to celebrate good things. Like, unemployment falling 10 basis points is a large group of Americans who have employment.
Yeah.
Have, like, know where their next mail's coming from. So, like, I don't know. Everybody gets politically divisive. I'm like, dude, sweet. We got another 0.10% of the labor force that's employed. Why can't we just be happy about that?
Well, I think the real question is it real? Because I think people are getting a little annoyed at seeing these things get revised by large amounts after the fact.
Yeah, it's always people with journalism, political science degrees. It's never a guy who knows how to use a calculator. That's okay. Upset at revision.
Right. Walk me through it.
No, it's like, what are we going to do? What do you want to do, like Soviet Union style, Kyle? Like, we just don't know. All statistics are good. Never revise them. That makes it harder to do economic forecasting.
But it's a lot easier for us to not complain about it if you just shoot the people who disagree.
Okay, I don't want to like endorse that, but I get what you're saying. I don't support that.
I don't either. But no, you're right. But sometimes the revisions just seem a little egregious.
Yeah, I mean, unemployment, like, my background is labor economics, so I'm probably way too hypersensitive and being really childish about this, but it's hard to predict people. It really is. Like, people are weird, man. I mean, like, I put myself first on that list, but I just hate when we critique. Like, I know economists who work at the BLS. They are, like, the most apolitical individuals in the world. They don't give a crap whose team is in office.
Right.
And like, what, we had tons of revisions under all presidents, and now it's like, oh, it's a revision in an election year. It's like, nah, man, it's just a revision.
Oh, they were going on 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Ever since I've been watching it, they've been going on.
They've been doing revisions since, I think, like the 70s. Like, it's just once you get better data, you re-report the numbers. So nerds like me who have to build forecasts based on these have more accurate data. Do you know where they don't do revisions?
Well, hold on. Here's the real question, Eric. When you're getting feedback like that and revisions are coming back, that should be improving the statistical viability of your models, correct? Yeah. So are the revisions getting less or are you getting more accurate since the 70s? That's the question.
Yes, we have been. Yeah, like generally speaking, labor models are they're definitely more robust. Yeah. That's a good question, Kyle. That is, because it's like, I don't know, it's kind
of
like.
Well, that's the whole point of the feedback. If you're going to do revisions, you should be using it to, you know, fix the model.
Yeah. I mean,
why don't they use older data?
What do you mean?
Like, why don't they say, like, instead of saying this is as of September, why don't they say as of July it was this?
Yeah, because that makes a ton of sense, Joel.
Joel just fixed the economy.
Instead of in September saying, well, now it's this, and actually it was that.
Yeah. The big reason they do that is they're trying to push as much information forward for policymakers. But, like, you know, and this is as somebody who gives data to policymakers, like, you try to give people the most information, the most accurate information, but you're right. Like, the shorter time frame you have to report, the less likely it is to be perfect data.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like when you look at a hurricane and it shows like the spaghetti mapping. That's kind of what some of those are similar modeling techniques. That's what you're trying to do. And the more time you have afterwards, you can say, oh, that's where the hurricane went through. That's where the tornado hit. Otherwise, you're just kind of saying, I think it's generally in this area.
It's funny you use weather as a corollary or your example, because weather is kind of the opposite. The more further out you get from it, the less accurate it is.
Time series wise. Yeah. But I'm saying like after the
Oh, no, that's effect. Forecasting. After. Never mind. That's different. Yeah. Never mind.
It's the same how weather is never right either.
Yeah, but they're getting better at it, though. They're getting way better at it.
I got an argument somebody recently about this saying, oh, yeah, because like there's a joke that like, economists are the meteorologists of statistics, and I'm always like, meteorologists are the meteorologists of statistics. So I got an argument with somebody recently on this, and I said, if you had a financial analyst who was as accurate as a meteorologist, it'd be the richest person in the world.
That's true.
Yeah, no shit.
That's true. So like, we'll sit down and be like, yeah, Warren Buffett, yeah, all these guys, and I love Warren Buffett, I shouldn't crap on that, but like, yeah, all these guys are brilliant. And it's like, dude, you're like, if you're a 58% accurate trader, you are one of the greatest traders in the world. But, you know, Sherry Spears on Fox 25 is right 95% of the time, but otherwise gets, like, shit on for the 5% she's not right. It's like...
people don't understand. 60% still means there's a 40% chance it's not going to rain. That doesn't mean it's going to rain.
Yeah. No, people just don't understand statistics. Yeah, that's why people, so people get angry at it. You know, everybody in life likes that little countdown clock until the light turns green. Like, that's what people think statistics are.
Nice.
As you can tell, I'm very bitter about this.
Should we keep them going on statistics, or should we
get it's fun. I love statistics, so I mean, if you want to school me, bring it.
All right. What's your interest in statistics, Joel?
The fact that the numbers don't lie.
Yeah.
When you
I can lie to you with numbers, man. I can do that real quick. Are you serious? Oh,
boy, here we go.
0.99999 equals one.
Yep. Yeah. One divided by three. 0.333 repeating. Yeah. Three together.
2 + 2 is always 4.
Yeah, I mean it is if you if you're using a Cartesian plane.
That's right.
Yeah, but I mean, like, statistics isn't basic humor.
In statistics here. You and I have very different ideas of statistics.
Yeah, no, but like, but that's not like if you're just saying any integer is a statistic. Like, I low key love that. Every new analyst who I hire, I buy them the. I don't know if you guys ever read it. It's called Business Numeracy or the Number Book by The Economist, and it's just like a book on like. Hey, so these are how numbers work, and nobody takes numeracy classes anymore. So we're just gonna give you a crash course in this.
That's perfect.
Yeah, but like,
what is it?
Let me see if I can pull it up. It's a sick book. I keep it on my desk. It's like a dictionary for numbers, which would be funny if that was just a book of just numbers in order.
Yeah, I know. Right? Let me look it up. Man, what? I can't remember what this. What's my rent this month? I can't remember. Look it up.
7.
God, I wish. Not in Quincy. God damn. We did look
very at... Very desirable place to live. Ooh, they put the new edition out. Oh, no, this is it.
We did look at some places out there just to see what it was. Oh, my God, fuck that. All I could afford was a shirt.
Dude, Quincy is lit, man. People, like, it just keeps getting, like, we're just getting more and more development. People love being here. Where's the chat function?
Trends with statistics.
Well, like, how do you define a trend?
By laying the statistics next to each other over a period of time.
Yeah, but like a trend line, right?
Yeah, like we use them at work to track the number of jobs that get done in a year versus last year. How much is done by our people? How much is done by contractors? How long each job takes? That kind of stuff. I love that stuff. I think it's so neat.
Yeah,
you can find efficiencies and inefficiencies.
Yeah, so those are, yeah, so summary statistics, as it's called. Yeah, like what we do a lot with economics and in financial analysis is causal. What causes you to be quicker at a job? What causes you to have more jobs? That's different, like how you look at that. Because like it's stochastic probability versus deterministic probability. And that's where you have to like have causal tools like IV, diff and diff, synthetic control.
Okay.
Keep going.
I want to tie this back to like trading though. So how can we use that mode of statistical analysis towards like looking at like a data set of trades?
Yeah, so I mean like one of the cool things is like pairs trading. I was actually talking to our business analyst is awesome. He's currently he's getting his master's in statistical practicum. So unfortunate for that young man, I do not shut the hell up when I talk to him because I think what he's doing is fascinating and obviously a supply economist or like that. So you guys familiar with pairs trading?
Like when you trade like oil and gasoline futures together or something or currency pairs or?
Kyle, I love you. You went right to like the actual way you're supposed to do pairs trading, which killed all my momentum. Excellent.
My bad.
But you're 100% right. So pairs trading is when you take two assets, usually stocks, that can be expressed as prices of each other. Mm-hmm. So take the two most common for pairs trading, I think, are Chevron and Exxon. So those two should exist at some perfect ratio over like a 50-year horizon looking at the prices, right?
Okay.
So what you do is that if Exxon's price, you know, goes higher than what that, you know, assumed long-term split between the two is, then you'd buy a put on it or short it. And then if it drops below that predictive line, you buy a call on it, right? Because it's underneath and it'll come back. It's a it's the idea of these two things orbit each other and dance throughout time.
Right.
And there's a couple different ways to build models on that, like autoregressive, gasoline prices, stuff like that, to try and create synthetic like demand in your model. But yeah, that's how you can do that. And that's like, we'd call that deterministic probability, because like two things are determining one another.
But then that's also ignoring all of the other, I guess, factors that are different to each of those companies.
No, so you can build that in the model. It's a concept called heteroscedasticity, which is the concept that like your error term and the factors that you are not testing for aren't evenly distributed in the same manner in both data sets. If they are, that's called homoscedasticity. But yeah, no, so there are ways to build models around that. You could have, like, technically you're supposed to do partially autoregressive. So I'll get real nerdy here. It's called a partially autoregressive hedonic model. It's the idea that you're using the previous Exxon price, the current Chevron price, and then other market explainers like current oil prices, current demand, time of year, the number of days it takes for like an oil tanker to get across the Atlantic, which is like a whole crazy data set. But then you may have some probit variables, the variables that just turned off or on based on if those characteristics apply at that time. And then you run the model and like, boop. And based on that number, that your dependent variable is time, the current time value, the current value at this time for the Exxon price. And if it's higher, if you're looking at the stock and it's higher than that, say it's just 50, say the model says it's $50 and the current price is $55, then you buy a put on it, because mathematically, and you have so much data for that, because you have data for, like, you can do it in 1 hour increments all the way back. I think you can get hour increments all the way back to like the 80s from what I've seen. I don't know how accurate those are. I don't go back to like the 2000s.
Joel, what does your Python library have? You were getting intraday, weren't you, on there?
Yeah, I have 1 minute back to 2018, 2017. I have like 6-7 years of 1 minute.
That's sick.
I believe in 1 hour data, you'd be able to get. Yeah, I have like 1.8 million bars.
Do you get that for individual stocks too, or is that just for the SPYs and like Qs and stuff?
That I don't. I've never tried, but that would be sweet.
Is it through Wi-Fi nets?
No, because I pulled mine out of CQG.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
If we can get a data set, is that something you think you could help us build?
That is cool.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've built these before. They're goofy as fuck.
Yeah, that could be fun. Just a fun exercise to do, maybe.
As Kyle puts millions of dollars.
If I had millions.
I was like, why is the house mortgaged?
Right? Again. Joel, I think I cut you off a little bit there.
You would be able to pull a ton out of TradingView, though. 1 hour.
Yeah, you probably. Well, I think you need a premium subscription to them, but yeah, I think you can get a lot out of them.
We can find that.
I know I can get daily candle data from YFinance on Python libraries. We could pull that back.
Dailies is probably better. I mean, like,
yeah,
you really shouldn't use, I don't know, man, people disagree with this, but I don't know if you should use pairs dating for intraday trading. Just my opinion on that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's so many macroeconomic variables for things like oil trading, because it's usually really good for, like you said, Kyle, for commodity based stocks, that I would prefer I'd do it like weekly if I was doing it.
Right.
Let's do this. Let's all throw in like a grand and see what happens.
Yeah, all right. See what happens.
I want to see your math first, but you know.
now you want to see my math?
I saw the models that you built for Boeing. Those were really cool.
Yeah, everybody, I've been on a few shows. Everybody thinks that's the most fascinating thing in the world, and I just buy Boeing every week. I just have no anything else, but I just buy Boeing. I'm like, listen, man, there's two large body aircraft manufacturers in the world. One's owned by a government and one's heavily subsidized by the most powerful military on Earth. Like, well, you're going to be fine with Boeing. Like, Boeing's not going anywhere.
They may lose their NASA contract, but.
Oh, yeah, that's embarrassing. Yo, Elon, can you take my gas home? Dude, that's like calling an Uber and get picked up by a Lyft. That's got to suck for the brain.
Oh, God.
I'm proud of that joke.
That was a good one. All right, I think we should probably get Purdue's question now, because I don't know how long this is going to take.
should I go refill my bourbon? Is that what you thought?
Nah, you're good. You're good.
Buffalo.
Okay. Purdue just wants to know what your definition of the economy is.
Why does this person hate you? I don't know. I would define the economy as a summation of everybody's scarce decision making.
Boom.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, I'm super Austrian. So to me, the economy is you take everybody who's making a decision, because those people know decision making better than the government does, or better than even the smartest economists. The guy buying a sofa knows more about his personal economy than I'll ever know. And you just sum all those people together, man on the spot. It's like Hayek calls it man on the spot, that individual decision maker. I call, you know, you can call it men on the spot. It's like, what's the total of everybody?
So how do you do that? How do you build up? Because you have to do a lot of averages and means, I'm assuming, in order to come with those values.
Yeah, so I was, dude, one of the coolest moments of my life was being on that Harris Business School for the University of Chicago, because, like, I'm really Austrian. Mm-hmm. And so I'm on that group, and I'm just like, you know, I consider myself an Austrian who likes econometrics, because, like, Austrianism is a heterodoxic field that usually, like, isn't super down on econometrics. And, like, listen, if there's anybody who's, like, super Austrian, they're probably, like, yell at me for that. Like, oh, that's a definition from 100 years ago. And they're right. But that's usually, like, the negative thing it gets. So with us, it's about investigating decision-making. It's, like, neutral analysis. Like, you're looking to understand why a decision was made, not how to change that decision was made. So, I mean, there's many ways to do it. I mean, it's very block-up analysis. Like, you start with very simple assumptions, and then you move northward using more advanced statistical analysis. I'm always a big fan of RDD, regression discontinuity design, where you're just like, somebody made a decision and you analyze that moment the decision was made and what in the market caused that decision to be made. Why did the price move at that exact moment? And then you can just hypothesis test around that using like RDD. But again, RDD is not going to express the value of a variable. It's just going to tell you that event, the, you know, material impact of that event.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah. So, I'll give you a crappy example. I'll give you the Boeing, like that model. That's just RDD. All we're doing is looking at when there's a Boeing accident or there's a Boeing report and saying, how does it affect the stock? And Boeing takes, they're called bandwidths. You have your normal bandwidth. Then they double that distance and they cut that distance in half and they measure it. Was there a statistically significant impact from that? Mm-hmm. And what we find is that in the long run, Boeing always recovers. Their stock always recovers.
Is that just survivorship bias, though? I mean, they recover because they are still here.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh, Kyle, that's a really good question. So, like, do we see survivorship bias in RDD? Like, you have to inherently still have data after the cutoff point, right?
Yeah.
100% right on that. But have there been permanently suppressed stock prices? Yeah. I don't know, Kyle. That's more of a question for you.
Well, you see, like, a lot of people point to something like the SPY, like a way it increases in value every year, but it's also not the same companies that make up that index every year anymore.
Thank you. You beat me to saying it. That's why you should not. That's why I always get weird when people do long-term pairs trading with SPY. And I'm like, you realize you're changing the composition of what that is. It has to be the same asset over time. And it's like, if it changes in composition, that's something materially mm-hmm. different. It's like, I don't know. It's like people who still invest in the Dow Jones indexes. I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I like trading Dow. That was a fun market.
What happened in your life that made you do that? Do you drink milkshakes? Or, not milkshakes, like
Werther's.
What happened to you in that submarine, Kyle?
Hey, look, come on, dude. Dow is wild, like NQ on the futures market, the way it moves. But it's also like a tenth the price, it feels like. It's almost like a trading a micro.
Oh, I like that. I like that, Ant. Oh, Kyle.
Okay. Yeah. It's wild, but it doesn't hurt as much.
That's a good point. I'll give you that. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. It's just so dense. It's such a dense index. It's just like, it's just like the firms in there, they're just all stuck together. Like, they're all moving. Like, there's no dynamicism.
Does the railroad trend still hold, where the railroads are going up, then that precedes the economy moving?
Yeah, I guess. Like, railroads are just, like, it depends. Like, to me, I'm all like, where are the railroads going? So, like, the largest trading partner with the U.S. now is Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, like, onshoring. So, I don't know if you guys know, with, like, railroads, like, you'll get the railroad companies they don't stop at the border for customs. They'll stay on the tracks until they reach, like, they'll go all the way to, like, Kansas and stuff, and then they have secured ports of entry that are in, like, Kansas.
Right, the custom ports are, yeah.
Yeah, I think the more building of those custom ports you'll see will be more.
Oh, does that mean the Border Patrol can operate within 200 miles of that port of entry?
No, so there's a weird, like, rule with how, like, it's why, like, Border Patrol, Kyle, this is a wicked question, I looked into this. It's why, like, Border Patrol and ICE aren't the same organization.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought that same thing. I'm like, so is the Border Patrol there? They're like, no, it's just ICE.
That makes a little more sense. Because the way the Border Patrol is allowed to work is kind of scary. 200 miles from any border, like, you can draw that. That gets you pretty far into the country all around.
It's like, it's like the Coast Guard. It's just like the Coast Guard low key covers, like, right. Like Vermont.
yeah. Have you seen how many Canadians are masked at the borders? I mean, Joel's over there. He's been reporting on this for years. 90% of the population, man, right along the border.
50% of Canada is below the 54th parallel.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're just waiting.
Joel, are you Canadian?
Very. Alberta.
Very Canadian. Oh, beautiful here. My dad used to hunt up in Canada, so he's obsessed with the Maritimes. And my dad is a red-blooded Reaganite, and the love he has for your beautiful land is just impeccable. Canada can do
he's
no
trying
wrong.
To get me to come out to Banff. I just saw some pictures of that. Oh my god, it looks gorgeous.
Why would you go to Alberta? It's like the prettiest area in like North America.
Alberta's awesome.
How far is the drive, Joel? I think that's why. Is it like 17 hours? And I got a
no. It was 23, just over 23 hour drive.
23. God damn, that's ridiculous.
but if you fly,
well, I also have to get into Canada too, and I'm not sure I'm allowed in there anymore.
That's fair.
Yeah, they got all kind of crazy when Trump got elected about not taking people who had any sort of past infractions with the law.
What are we stealing in Canada? Don't touch our maple syrup. They're strategic reserve.
Dude, maple syrup's fucking good, dude.
I just think it's weird that Canada has a maple syrup cartel. How do you feel about that as a red-blooded Canadian?
They have a cartel?
Yeah,
I don't know about this. I'm not part of it.
Of course, that's what you say, Joel.
Are you wearing a wire?
Yeah, it's a legal cartel, but it's a cartel. Yeah, it's like OPEC for, like, you can't just, like, I think it's in Quebec. Like, you can't just, like, it's run through Quebec, I should say. Yeah, you just can't, like, harvest maple syrup. You have to have, like, a special permit. You have to wait, like, years to do it. You can only harvest so many gallons, and they buy it. They hold it like a giant strategic reserve, and the Canadians were like, yeah, but Vermont, can you stop making maple syrup? And Vermont's like, no, you don't allow a shortage in the market. We will exploit it.
America. That's awesome.
As a true New Englander, do you realize how backwards you have to be for Vermont to sound like the capitalists? Like, where Bernie Sanders is talking about, oh, you got the X and the Y, the equilibrium, like that you've lost the cost. Joel, how do you feel about Canada's refusal to spend money on defense?
Why would they?
How would they?
No, why would they? If anybody's going to mess with Canada, they're going to be messing with us.
Yeah. I wish we spent more money on defense, but we don't. The next government might. It's hard to say.
Joel works in the infrastructure area. He does he's a lineman over there.
Yeah. Oh, first off, sick job. Thank you. Because linemen are like actually keep like the modern world running. So I super appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I obviously want all countries to, you know, meet the minimum NATO spend. But as an economist and a red-blooded American, I have very mixed feelings about this because I understand Canada's rationale where they're like, of course the U.S. is going to step up and protect us. Absolutely. All that stuff.
Right.
And, you know, part of me wants to be like, Canada, carry your portion of NATO. But then the red-blooded Americans in me, if another nation touched one fucking inch of Canadian soil, I would demand that my government to defend
they
Canada.
Took one fucking maple leaf home.
Like, I want all-out war to defend Canada. I find myself being like, Eric, you're the reason why they don't need to spend more money on defense, because I feel like I'm part of the majority of Americans who are like, if they turned, if Kazakhstan turned over one stone in Canada, I would want to topple their government. I would demand the U.S. military spends billions of dollars.
Here's
protecting the
deal, Eric.
Canadians.
We have a deal with Canada. Canada is just holding all of their strategic reserves for us when everything runs out. And exactly. In turn, they get a ride to the end with us.
Yeah. You got like Root, the head of NATO. He's big on like, because Canada's, I mean, I think Canada spends like 1.37% GDP on military. He's like, guys, don't spend more on military. Just like keep all your resources. So like if we have to fight a war, Canada can just be like, oh, we have all the oil.
We have all the minerals. Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. What do you need?
I swear, I think that's why we put up with OPEC and let them do whatever they want to do. It's just, we'll use up all your oil first and then we'll Then we'll use ours.
Yeah, I just like that. Like, Canada's like, yeah, we got 12 people who produce that. Let's check 80 billion barrels of oil a day. The numbers are way off. Like, everybody in Canada's just fucking shipping oil down to the U.S. Love it.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
I just love that you guys showed up and saw a bunch of like black sand. You're like, this, the Americans will love this. We'll ship this down to Texas.
That's actually where, like, I live not far from all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like in Alberta, where we ship all our oil sands.
Yeah.
That's like my stomping ground.
I also like how you guys are like, hey, U.S., do you want us to like squeeze this first? Nah, just heat it up, put it in a pipeline. It's like, yeah. You don't want us to refine it? Nope, send it down. It's like the fat guy at like a KFC. Like, do you want napkins? Nope. Everything's getting licked.
Just the skins.
No, so yes, I understand that I am the problem with Canadians' defense spending, is that I am the American who's like, yeah, I want you to spend more money, but also I am willing to engage in LISCO if it means protecting all Canadians.
Speaking of Canada, this is something I learned recently, actually from the first April when we were down for the municipal bond release.
Yeah.
I didn't realize the Manifest Destiny is for basically all of America.
Yeah, Reverend Winthrop, city on hill. Yeah, and Winthrop, if you look on a map, is like in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Massachusetts. It's like a peninsula. He meant like Quincy's probably part of Manifest Destiny. Right.
Yeah, I don't know if you know that, Joel, but apparently part of Manifest Destiny was to incorporate all of Canada and bring you guys back home, too.
Let's do it.
The Articles of Confederation said that you guys could join. You guys just had to vote. You could just join us.
Does that still work like that?
I don't think so. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, Kyle. But,
I don't know. Those Tea Partyists seem to really hold it in high standards.
Fuck it. Dude, it's amazing the United States survived the Articles of Confederation and just were like, wait, hold on a minute. And it's like, banger, best constitution in the world. It's quiet. Dude, had me in the first half. And then you came back and dominated. We get James Madison, and we get a copy of the Massachusetts Constitution, same room, cheat off that homework, get that squared.
Dude, why is the Mayflower Compact not talked about more in schools?
I don't know, because it affected like six people and like, I don't know, spread disease to a continent. Like,
yeah, but it also was like the blueprint of like democracy. Kind of an important moment. If they hadn't have decided to just stop there, if they landed in Norfolk or where their original charter was meant to be, or if they landed at their backup charter at New York, it'd be a completely different thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a bunch of dudes who are like, hey, let's let everybody do what they want to do and have a system of government in place. And somebody
worked for a little bit.
Somebody's like, yo, man, this guy's spitting bars. Like, he's just talking about like democracy. it's taught. Like, see, my thing is, I'm being from Massachusetts. Like, we get taught all this stuff.
Yeah, in Tucson, Arizona, it was not that big of a part of the curriculum.
I would kill to know what was going on. What was like, how was American history? The Texas War of Independence. How was that taught where you're from?
That the Texans fought for independence.
They were fighting for slavery. We're all aware of that, right? They were the bad guys in the story.
Yeah, no, that was never really brought up too much. There's a lot of things that got kind of swept under the rug.
I remember being like sixth grade and like we were learning about it. I was just like, I'd be like little sixth grade Eric, but I was probably like 5'10 at the time. Just like a man child, probably. I had like horrible like whiskers in my facial hair area because I had learned to shave yet because I was like 10 years old, but the size of like a normal size adult.
Yelling about bricks in the classroom.
Tell you, they're gonna fool me. My voice is off. So my voice dropped pretty early, so I probably did have a deep voice to be yelling about like some international trade agreement.
Did you scare some teachers when you were a kid?
Like, Eric, you need to go get. I got tested twice, and both came back negative. So I guess that's okay. As my brother says, to test you twice. That's a positive. They still haven't found the right test. I love my brother. My brother's my favorite person. Texas War of Independence. I was just like, we're like sitting there waiting. I'm like, wait, weren't these guys that went down there for slavery? And then like, yo, the Mexicans were like, yo, you can like live here, but like, just let you know, we're Catholic, and the Catholic Church, like at that point, had outlawed slavery. So like, yo, can you not bring slaves? Because the French Empire doesn't have slaves. And like, yo, what's up? And the Texans were like, what if we brought slaves? And it was like, can you not do that? It's like, like, all right, let's have a war over this. And it's like, the Alamo with the good guys. I'm like, feels like, I'm just, historically, if you're ever the side fighting for, if you have a war break out because of slavery, and you're not on the side trying to not propagate slavery, you're the bad guys.
Do you ever watch that David Mitchell? What is he? He's a British comedian. He used to do a sketch thing called A Bit of Webb and Mitchell. But there's a skit that they do with where they're both dressed up like Nazis and in World War II, and they're like talking to each other. You're like, Franz, are we the baddies? What do you mean? It's like, well, look at our uniforms. They got skulls and like this doesn't look right. are we on the right side?
Yeah. So I don't know. I've always had this weird thing about the Alamo where I'm just like,
I got a picture of me trying to pee on it. Ooh, and I got.
Impressive. And now you're not allowed into Canada.
Yeah, funny how that works, right?
Canadians, huge fans of the Alamo.
Yeah, they love it, buddy.
I just see. I think, and I'm going to sound like a Massachusetts elitist. I just think of Massachusetts best history.
You must love Ozzy Osbourne then, too.
Why would I love Ozzy Osbourne?
Because he did pee on the Alamo, and he got kicked out of the state for it.
Yeah, I also don't want to pee where people died, so I don't know how I feel about that.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I do have respect.
He also snorted a line of ants, too, so.
Oh, yeah, did you better hit off a bat?
Yeah. Yeah, somebody told him that he should, what was the line? No, never mind, I don't remember the South Park line.
No, I just,
can we circle back to Canada? I have a question.
Yeah, we can always circle back to Canada.
So, can you validify, I read an article, I cannot find it for the life of me, that for the first time in years, there is more money flowing from Canada into the U.S. versus flowing from the U.S. into Canada?
My opinion should, as always, mean nothing. I can check the FDI rate. I have Fred up right now, Federal Reserve Economic Database. Canada?
Like, from a, would it be called an economic standpoint?
Yes, it would be.
Canadians spend more money in U.S. and companies spend more money in U.S. So money is actually leaving Canada.
Oh, I think that's been going on for a little bit. So Canadian GDP per capita has been on the decline. I use it as your GDP's climb because you've had fairly large immigration.
Right.
Which obviously upsets that.
Obviously.
Huge immigration.
Foreign direct investment. All right. So you have... Dude, Canada? Dude, I didn't know that. Canada? Wow. Dude, yeah, no, you guys are at you guys had a $1 trillion deficit.
Yeah.
In foreign direct investment. Like, there's Canada invests 2.1 trillion out and gets 1.3 trillion back in. According to, like, Stats Canada.
Right.
Wow. That is way bigger than I thought it would be.
Which is not good, right? For the country.
Is that just from like investments and stuff? Because if you invest in like the American stock market, does that count as going? Because they haven't lost it. It hasn't gone anywhere. Well, not yet, at least.
Yeah. So first off, Kyle, as you were talking, the page loaded. Yeah. So you're right. The majority of it goes to the U.S. stock market or the U.S. market. But we know
like
it's
401k stuff, like probably that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Wow, that is crazy. So yes and no. So capital flows to the highest rate of return. That is, if you have a free market, capital always find the area that gets the most amount of return for adjusted for the amount of risk that's exposed to it. So you could just have, there's a couple situations where you would see more FDI out. So So the U.S. is an abnormal monster where it has very, very high labor costs and very, very high capital assigned per worker. And it still receives massive amounts of foreign direct investment. And it also has a lot of internal domestic investment poured into its own market. Canada's a weird beast when it comes to that, because you got to understand is that Canada's a very, you know, this Joel, you know this Kyle, Canada's a very advanced economy. They are a G7 economy. They're a robust economy with a very educated workforce. As much as everything in Canada's not, you know, it may feel like to the average Canadian, I love like all politics in the Western Hemisphere. I follow Latin American politics. I follow, Central American politics. I follow Canadian politics. It may feel like everything's not going great. And like, yeah, is Trudeau probably going to lose? I mean, I think he's polling at like 27% now. He's probably going to lose. It's still important to remember that like Canada's still an ultra advanced economy. All right. And is it in a GDP stagnation? Yes. But always be careful when politicians weaponize economics, because economics is inherently a complicated, convoluted, and it's called the dismal science for a reason, complicated field that is never going to give the answer you want. And at the end of the day, it's like Canada is still an ultra-advanced economy. It is still a top five, I would say, economy in the world. Maybe not in size, but in skill set, in natural resources, and in minerals. Like, Canadians should be proud of their economy. It may not be optimized to where like every Canadian wants it to be, just like the U.S. economy isn't optimized to where every American wants it to be. But at the end of the day, it's like Canada should be proud of this ultra-advanced economy. It has stuff it has to fix. But what's important to remember is that foreign direct investment means you guys have money to invest other places.
There you go. Yes.
Okay.
North Korea doesn't have a lot of FDI. Iran doesn't have a lot of FDI. The Congo does not have a lot of FDI. What you would maybe want to be concerned with, and I'd say like a Canadian listening to this and want to follow this closer, and I'd say this as an economist, not as a CFO, as an economist, I would say, was that dollar, other dollars that were originally invested in Canada's economy, that the investor is now saying, I'm not getting a high enough rate of return, and then when reassign that dollar to a different nation, that would be a problem. But it's like Kyle's heard me complain, and I've said this, you know, at conferences and stuff, where I get angry when people complain about the U.S. trade deficit. We're the richest country on earth. Who do you want us to trade with who has more money than us? We're always going to have a trade deficit. So, yeah, I mean, but you're right. I don't want to call it a huge disparity. It's just a bigger disparity than I would have thought. I wouldn't have expected a 40-60 split in favor of trade outside of your market.
Especially, like you say, it's already a very rich economy. So yeah. Why are people leaving? Like, why is investment leaving if our economy is so rich?
Well, Joel, I mean, how many people are buying houses in the U.S. to come, like, spend their winters down here, like that kind of stuff? That is all going to count towards
that's true.
Yeah. Kyle, right on.
In fact, can we dig into those numbers? Is there any way to see more into that or no?
Yeah. They have everything at the Federal Reserve Economic Database. I love everybody who works there.
He's emailing him right now.
I know one economist who works there, and I'm so scared to email him because I think like if I email him too much, he just won't answer me. It's like I went to grad school with an economist at BLS, and she's like literally one of the best economists I ever met. And I really like don't want to ask her questions because I just think she's going to be like, Eric, shut up. Like, I'm not answering any more of your questions.
Hey, any of them want to be on a podcast?
You probably get the dude at the Fred, you could probably get on a podcast, and he is way wilder than me. Except he can't talk about stuff as freely as me. Because he has access to information that like you. Like he does data series analysis for data series that aren't public yet. And I just imagine that dude just gets his every invest. They probably don't allow him to invest. He probably legitimately is not allowed to invest in his own managed portfolio.
We need to talk to him when he quits, when he finally leaves there. That's when you got to talk to these guys.
Yeah.
How do you feel as a Canadian, Joel? I'm curious about that.
I think our economy is doing good. It's interesting to see in Alberta how much business is leaving. Like, we're right in the heart of oil country, and we're closing in wells every day.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Large companies, I'm going to just leave them nameless because it's rumor, but are leaving the country for better opportunity, lower taxes, less regulation. So that's what it's kind of interesting to see. I can hear your number.
Are they leaving the country completely, or are they just moving their headquarters somewhere else?
Nope, closing the suitcase, leaving the country.
Really? Even with what's going on in the Middle East, you think that oil would be doing well. I don't think anybody would be. Somebody's going to scoop that up.
So, like, but that's the thing, is like oil is doing well, mm-hmm. right? But oil isn't doing well because of Canada. Oil is doing well because of the demand.
Alberta's oil is always like that though, right?
Alberta's oil is like, it gets harder and harder to get.
Yeah.
Because of all the regulation and the rules that are put in, people don't want to do the hassle. They go across the border down into Montana or North Dakota and then just drill underneath Canada.
Yeah. Like, they steal your milkshake.
Exactly.
Did nobody else see that movie? Come on.
No, Kyle, I don't know, no milkshake stealer.
There Will Be Blood?
I haven't seen There Will Be Blood. I feel like it's a movie I should
see. God damn it. Yeah, you guys should see that one. That's a good one.
Kyle, so you are very right. Almost half of Canadian purchases of U.S. real estate are for vacation and summer. 49%.
Wow.
The Canadians are the largest foreign purchasers. They purchase 13% of all farm buyers of homes in the United States are Canadians.
Really? Farms?
Yeah. Let's see what else. So in 2024, Canadian buyers purchased about 7,100 real residential properties in the United States. Which is a ton, by the way. Just like, you know, 7,100 is actually a fair amount. Down from 69,000 in 2010, which is an insane number.
What?
That's over 1,200 homes a week in 2010 were purchased by Canadians. How many people in Canada? Like 50 million?
Yeah, dude, they were advertising in Arizona, I remember. When I was selling a house, they were actually putting out advertisements in hot markets in Canada to try to sell it.
What?
Probably getting close to 50 million people.
That was like 2012.
There's only 38 million Canadians, and you guys are buying, like, that's the thing. Like, once you buy a vacation home, it's like you're buying one every year, so you should see a dip in demand over time. What the hell? Okay, yeah. So, yes, people are buying. Dude, I love when I learn stuff like this. That's awesome. Kyle, were you the one who fact-checked me when I said, like, nobody, like, there's not that many adults over the age of 25 who are unemployment?
I don't think that was me. I don't think I'm smart enough to fact-check you.
Somebody fact-checked me on that. They brought it up. They were like, wait, what, like, 1% of the population over 25 is on minimum wage? I was like, yeah. They're like, they thought it was like 40% of the population. I was like, no, America's rich, dude. Like, we have, if Spain or Portugal was a state, it would be the poorest state by 40%.
Portugal's kind of a shit show, though.
We are rich. Like, oh, dude, you can throw Germany over here. It's one of the poorest states.
Germany, too, really?
Yeah, dude, we dunk on other countries.
Doesn't Spain still have, like, a bunch of ghost cities that they built up that nobody moved into, kind of like China had?
Yeah. And also, Spain still has a demand, has a, like, a quota economy where they're like, we need to produce this many toothbrushes. It gets, dude, Spain gets weird because you can't, like, fire people. So, like,
sounds efficient.
Yeah, style. Spain's economy is weird. They have, like, massive youth unemployment because they have this system where, like, you can't fire anybody. So, mm-hmm. instead, these companies form, like, contractors and then hire people and fire them as they want. So, you end up with, like, youth unemployment being, like, 80%. Then, like, it's worse and worse. Don't mimic Spain.
That's the fascinating thing to me about, like, policies and laws is the unintended effects that come across from them. When you try to fix a problem, it creates another massive one. What was the one that was really cool? The ramps that you guys put on around Quincy, and like that was done for handicap ramps. Access, but then everybody rides a bike or a bicycle or a scooter or a skateboard. Like, they all make use of those ramps.
Yeah. I didn't talk about this, but I obviously talked to a lot of people in Quincy. I feel like I know what they're talking about and also vehemently agree with them. the Cobra effect, right? Like, the Brits were like, in India, were like, oh, there's too many snakes, so we're gonna give everybody a shilling for every cobra they bring us. So people decided breeding cobras, and then the Brits were like, oh, screw that, we're not paying for this anymore, and so people just released the cobras, and I had more cobras than you started with. Same thing happened in New York with rats. They were like, oh, rat tails are worth $3. People were like, dude, I'm gonna breed rats. Like, Doug, what a fucking psychopath. By the way, that you're breeding rats and chopping off their tits. Dude, if they just arrested the people who were handing in like 80 rat tails, I'd be fine with that.
God damn. Okay, I got one more question for you then. You mentioned being an Austrian again. Does your intern have any idea what that means yet? Has he ever asked you?
Oh, no, they have to come back and ask me. Yeah. I have three. We have three interns in municipal finance this year.
Yeah.
One of them's an econ major at a very, very prestigious school in Massachusetts. So he's like, he doesn't deal with any of my nonsense. He knows everything.
That wasn't the one. No. That wasn't the one we were talking to, right?
No, yeah. No. The one you were talking to, he's like, he's an econ major, but he's like, dude, he's like financial economics. And he is a blast to talk to because he's just like,
how did you get him out of his skin? I could not get him to budge.
I'm just goofy, dude. Also, you got to remember, it's a different thing. Like, I make sure my interns meet with me at least once a week when they're in. And yeah. As you know, I'm a goofy guy. I don't, you know, nah. You've been around my office what? And stuff like that. Like, I'm not a hierarchy guy. I'd sit on, if, you know, if it was possible, I'd have a desk on the floor when you have an office. So, like,
Why was my chair 6 inches shorter than yours then?
Are you sure it wasn't just because my legs are so lanky that I would have destroyed my knees off my desk if I was
just fucking with you? Nobody sits higher than the king.
Yeah, dude. Sometimes I'm like,
does the mayor make you do that when you sit down for a minute?
he has one chair in his office that like the back spring's gone. And I was sitting in it. This is probably a couple weeks, maybe like a month ago. I'm sitting in it and I'm like, I'll lean back. And I leaned back and I just fell into the window. He thought it was the funniest thing in the world. I was just like, I'm okay. Like, I'm so lanky that when I fall places, I can't like get myself back up. Dude, I was at the
like
bank.
A turtle?
No, that's honestly what it is. It's like a very elongated turtle. Dude, I'm like going, I was getting something out of drive thru. Oh, I was getting, I was picking up, we have like a Chipotle drive thru around here. And I went to it, and I went to hand the credit card receipt, but it was one of those new drive-thrus where, like, the window extends out. So yeah. I couldn't, like, hand my card because I couldn't get my elbow out the window enough without, like, jawing this poor lady behind the counter. So I'm like, here you go, ma'am. Oh, for the podcast listeners, that's not going to be funny at all. I'm all elbows, podcast listeners, when I'm doing that. Like, I can't, like, try and stick your elbow perpendicular to your body, perpendicular to your body while driving. And the glass right there is pretty much how my body has to function. So, So my interns, I have them meet with me once a week. And we keep our interns, we try and coach them through their entire time. There, right? So like I want them to feel comfortable. And the big thing to me is I want them to understand respect, as in they deserve to be respected. Like if any company you work in, all right, the CFO is usually the top guy when it comes to finance, right? I think that's what they have that title. And I make sure, and I tell them this, as goofy as it sounds, I say this directly to them, like, you deserve to be treated with respect. And a company that does not respect you or treat you with dignity is not a company you should work for, because they are not going to promote you. Forget about any personal feelings.
Right.
We have one of my interns, amazing kid. He's comes from a small business family. He ended up getting into Rothschild Investment Banking, and he was he's very good at his job. And he was he called me one time. He's over in London right now, actually going through training. And he said to me, one of the things that he would always ask questions when he was going through the training, and which is one of the reasons they selected him. And he cracked me up because he's like, I had no problem asking questions. He's like, I'd come and ask the CFO questions. I can ask some like junior associate a question, and I try and have that mentality with my interns. Like, you should ask questions so you build better models or you give better answers. Right. Like, if any boss is going to be like, I don't have time for you, like, that's a fail. That organization is going to fail anyway. So you might as well just leave now before it drags you down with it. So yeah, I eventually get, like, they feel obligated to sit down and listen to me talk about horribly stupid things. it was really funny. One time the chief of staff walked in, the chief of staff's obviously incredibly high up in the organization. He walks in, looks at my interns, goes, you don't need to listen to him, and walked out. And I was like, guys, by the way, he's 100% right. You can just leave. Like, you know the shit to do. I'm not gonna... So you get them open up eventually is the long answer to that.
Well, we know he wasn't listening to the podcast. Otherwise, he would have known what an Austrian was. We were wondering if that was who was sending in the homework. It was one of your interns.
Oh, they'd be so much meaner to me. One of my favorite things about my interns is that, like, I got a new swap of all. This is all their first year going through here. So they're still semi, like, way too rigid talking to me.
Yeah.
My other interns, they were here for 3 years. I have another intern who was here 3 years and is now doing a co-op program. And they all start off super shy. They won't say anything. And I'll say funny things to them. And they'll be like, Mm-hmm. Yep. And I'm like, I just said something outlandish to you. Like, I had this Nerf bottle launcher, like rocket launcher. So he's like a little Nerf that you punch this like little plastic thing and it'd fire up.
Nice.
Yeah. And I remember like one of them who's now, you know, works for the city. Great. Wicked smart kid getting his MBA. I'd walk by and I'd punch it and hit it at him. And he'd just be like, oh, and, like bring it back to me. I'm like, no, you're supposed to throw it back at me. What are you doing? Like,
you bring it back. You missed. Try again.
Yeah. Like, now that kid like will like shoot me with a Nerf gun if I walk too close to him. I love it.
Oh God, that's so funny.
But you got to break that down.
That sounds like somebody who's pledging. He's probably.
Yeah, they're really good kids, and like that's the thing. You want to encourage them to understand that they should be treated with respect, and that you know it's formality does not mean expertise. Does not.
I would like to say that's very cool, like thing to say. Because typically, if you, as someone who's a leader, if you say respect is important, most people, even I did when you said that, gravitate to respect the leader, respect your elder, respect that person in charge, but not respect the new guy.
Oh, that mine. I went to respect is earned.
Right? Yeah. But respect the new guy, respect the person who is learning. That's such a cool thing.
Yeah, I mean, I lucked out. So I took over my job when I was 26 in the middle of the pandemic because I was allowed to ask a lot of stupid questions. And I just appreciate that because I look at it this way. Like, our mayor's like, I mean, he's a very informal guy. And why should I ever be more aggressive than him? Why should I ever, like, don't get me wrong. I hold my staff and I hold my, you know, even my interns. I hold them to a high standard. But I'm there to help them reach that standard. I set expectations to help people work towards them. I'm not one of those guys where I'm like, you need to meet here and I'm going to sit in my office and never talk to you. It's like, no, I want to help you reach there. And,
right.
You know, our mayor's the same way. And I go, why should, if the, you know, the chief elected officer, if the CEO of the city holds it to that standard, who am I to just be somebody sitting in my, you know, corner office, you know, yelling at people to be better? Well, I get to get in the trench with them. I grew up with my dad, was a small business owner for his whole career. I watched that man sweep floors. I watched that man clean bathrooms. I watched that man say, I'll never tell somebody to do something that I haven't done myself. And I look at it that way all the way from interns, all the way up to, you know, people like Rick, who's like Rick's one of the highest finance people in the entire city. He manages a $1.3 billion debt portfolio. He manages tens of millions of dollars in invested assets. Like, that dude's legit as hell, but like, I would never, like, Rick and I get along great because Rick has a similar management style of that, where it's like, oh, I'm never just going to tell somebody to do something. I like Eisenhower, and Eisenhower always says, like, leadership is not just telling people what to do. It's getting people to do what you want them to do because they believe in what you're doing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I think that should apply to interns. And my thing is, I'm a big believer that you take young people, and I was lucky enough that when I was young, I had very, very good people to me who influenced my career and set it up for what I think, you know, not sound boastful, but it's a pretty good trajectory. And I know that at the beginning of these young men and women's careers, that we can set them up. If we just change one or two angle mm-hmm. of that launch, their career is going to be so much higher. And I want to support them. And you should see. I could do a freaking
launching
YouTube.
Launching them out of the stratosphere.
I could do a YouTube short channel that's just on how I write people who ask me for recommendations for these, you know, for my interns. I'm such an asshole. I probably shouldn't say this, but like, I call up, I'll find this, dude, it's LinkedIn, man. I'll find the CFO of the company they're applying for and I'll connect with them. And CFOs, if a CFO connects with you, mm-hmm. if or sends you a connection, you guys connect real quick. I'll be like, yo, can you call me and put my phone number in on my cell? And I'll call and I will just, A, recommend the hell out of it, and B, talk mad shit about the, like, tell me three weaknesses this person has. I'll write in there and be like, it's an entry level job. He has no material weaknesses. It's an entry level job.
Right.
Like, I'll call the CFO and be like, I don't know, you should be lucky this kid applied. What are you, and like, tons of my interns have gotten jobs. I'm just like,
wicked aggressive.
Oh, I'm super aggressive. Because most CFOs are kind of like me, where they're like, they love their job. They love, you know, trying to be as best they can be, make all those financial decisions, become an expert in what they need to be. But on the flip side, are kind of goofy guys. Like, they want to drink bourbon, they want to smoke cigars, they want to do stuff like that. So I'll call them up and I'll be like, hey, I talked to the CFO a few weeks ago about an intern who was applying for something after he had graduated. And the guy's name was Alex. He's really good shit. I really hope he's listening to this because he'll text me and talk mad crap about me. I was like, Alex, I go, this kid who applied, I go, it's one of the best workers I've ever had. I've known him forever. I go, you guys would be insane not to hire him. And like, he was like, you took time out of your day to call me and like effectively yell at me to hire this kid? Yes. Do you have any follow-up questions?
Who's your favorite intern, Eric?
Oh, I'm not going to say that. I love all of them. They're all different.
Well, come on. You got to have at least one that you still talk to or that you had the best relationship with.
Oh, well, Mike, who you met, Mike, he's the one office over for me. He was an intern. Oh, damn it, he was an intern for 3 years. I gave up part of my office to make him a bigger office.
I was going to say, wow. Yeah, I was going to suggest bringing one of them on just to shoot the shit and tell Eric story time maybe one of these days.
I don't want to, dude. I'm not going to give that for him, Kyle. I want to be employed in the future at different organizations. I got to like. what a horrible, horrible rant this morning about something. Oh, about lemurs. I went on a 10-minute rant this morning about lemurs.
Oh my God. What meeting was this in?
One of our analysts was doing something and he's doing a class for grad school and it had to do with like genetic diversity of primates in New World primates. And so we're talking about this. And I said, oh, well, I mean, you are aware that primates are incredibly ungenetically diverse compared to other, other animals. He's like, why would I know that primates are less genetically diverse? So I went on this like long rant about like lemurs, like, you know, which is like Latin for like old world monkeys, but like old monkeys. And I was explaining how like
the ring-tailed lemur. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, lemurs, like, you know, they, when you look at the, you know, prevalence of alleles in their genetic base, it's actually pretty similar to like low, like primates in Africa, like in mainland Africa, not in Madagascar. And I was like, you know, I was talking about like, when people look at dogs, like dogs are able to adopt alleles like sometimes faster than humans and all this evolution, yada, yada, yada. And after like 10 minutes, they're just like, why do you care so much about how you do the data analysis on like genetic backgrounds of lemurs? And I was like, because it needs to be done right. like having a cup of coffee, like three coffees in at this point. Like, dude, we're over by like, if Kyle, you've been in my office. We're over like in that little kitchenette set. I'm just pounding coffee. I'm like, oh, this is how you do it. It's a Moran eye, and I was given the history of like Jon Snow and like the Game of Thrones. Like, not the Game of Thrones. It's a geospatial data analyst from like the early 1800s who discovered cholera. I found out it was waterborne. Like,
were you drawing pins and were there lines connecting stuff on your whiteboard?
No, my office is does not let me have whiteboards on the floor for that exact reason. They are very good stuff. We had a whiteboard out there. They're just like, we're getting, dude, I love my office. They are so, I'm actually the most senior person in my office. She retires in a month. So I will now be the longest serving person in finance in my office, which feels very weird to say.
That is very strange because you're not an old guy either.
Turn 31 next week.
We'll do a big celebration for that.
You ever do the thing where you look at people or you hear them and you're just like, you have an idea of what they look like. And then you meet them and you're just like, wow.
Who are you referring to, Joel?
You know what? Actually, a lot of people on this podcast.
I know.
So many.
Banks, I will say, looked exactly what I thought Banks was going to look like.
Yep. I would agree with that.
Dude, so what's really funny is my office, I have a big and tall desk. I have a big and tall table. I have a huge monitor, like a curved monitor. So the camera is like on one of those elevated pivots because it comes out from inside the computer. So it's really funny because a lot of times if people meet me for the first time, they'll be like, oh, what the hell? I'm like a little over 6'4".
Camera's looking down on you?
Yes. And they're like, what? And I'm like, oh, they go, you look very proportional. And I'm like, and I'm not proportional. I have like a 6'8 wingspan. I'm just like lanky as hell. And they're like, I was like, no, all my office furniture is built to make me look normal on these meetings. Supports the financial integrity of the city that I don't look like an embodiment of large.
Oh God! All right, Eric, we gotta wrap this thing up. Okay, right? Anything else? Anything you guys want to share with people before we wrap up here? Anywhere they want to direct them to? Where was that podcast you just said you did?
Harris School of Business, Chicago. There's been a bunch of other stuff. I've had some articles on CFO Brew that they've done recently. December 3rd, if anybody's in Massachusetts and is going, it'll be posted more publicly, but Gray Gray and Gray Associates is bringing me back for a second year to do the 2025 economic outlook. We'll be talking tax policy. Awesome.
Are they streaming that?
Yeah, they'll be streaming it. They'll be doing recordings of it. Laura, her team is like the most amazing marketing people in the world. I'll be on that. There's some other podcasts coming out. If you guys want to check out CFO.com, recently did a leadership conference that me and the person who took the New York Stock Exchange public, Amy Butte, and I did a cool round table that was pretty funny. Dude, she's awesome. Kyle, you should try and have her on your show.
Yeah,
by the way.
I was gonna try to leverage my network as soon as
I'll email Amy and make the introduction. Are you on LinkedIn?
We are. I just finally got our stupid page updated. Finally, okay. It was still financial ineptitude, which I think has probably been hurting us.
China
Shop Productions now. It's fixed.
Which is a great name. I just love that fucking name.
It so was much. Great, but it did not do us any business or help. I'm sure every email I sent out got caught by everyone's spam blockers.
Dude,
how am I going to send you an invoice with something that says financial ineptitude on it?
Yep. No, that's a good. That is an excellent point. Yep. No,
it was a poor decision.
It fit at the time, though.
It was perfect at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, that was pissed. But yeah, send me that, Amy. Yeah. Dude, she is one of the funniest. Like, you're talking to somebody who's just an absolute expert. Like, literally one of the best people. Like, probably one of the best CFOs of the last 40 years. And she's like most down to earth, funniest person. I'm like, you would be excellent on this podcast.
Oh God, yeah, like, yeah. All right. Well, I guess I need to wrap this thing up then. Yeah, check the links for everything Eric said and like, share, subscribe, all that good stuff. Make sure you check out the Boston Blockchain Podcast. I'll put links to that too. We just released the first 9 episodes of that. We should have 2 more out by the time this gets released. A lot of really good stuff coming out of there. Joel, you got anything you want to say?
Come see Banff, Alberta.
Cool. Yes, I will. It's on my bucket list. All right, guys. This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only, does not constitute financial or investment advice, and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations. Produced by China Shop Productions.